This episode is sponsored by Our Crowd, where you can experience a new approach to investing with access to pre-vetted startup opportunities alongside trusted venture capital and angel investors. And you can learn more about this by visiting ourcrowd.com/TDI. And the Disciplined Investor is underwritten by Interactive Brokers, the professional's gateway to the world's markets. Their clients enjoy enhanced price execution via IB Smart Routing and lowest cost access to stocks, options, futures, and fixed income from a single integrated account. Learn more at ibkr.com.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And just like that, things change. Or do they? Hearing a loud crunching sound as high beta stocks are put through the grinder. Gut check time as key rates continue to move higher, and we're in the midst of tax season. And there's plenty of questions to get answered with our guest, tax expert, noted author, and CPA, Dan Pila. All this and much more on episode number 704 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, so much for March. Well, at least the first week. Coming in like a bear and questioning whether or not it's going to go out like a bull. A very fine day to you. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We're here approaching our 14th anniversary. Yep, that's 14 years of this podcast running continuously. In fact, we believe it's the longest running financial and investment podcast out there. Woo! Great. I'm Andrew Horowitz, your host. For those of you that are tuning in for the first time, welcome aboard the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We're going to get you to be a disciplined investor. And that's what we do every day. This is, again, not just some theory. What we talk about are the things that we're doing for our clients through our investment management and financial planning operation on a regular basis. Now, there's a lot going on. I got to say, we talk about that a lot. I say that a lot. There's a lot going on. But there is a lot going on right now. And I must say that this week has been, well, to put it mildly, a little rough on many of the MOMO or the momentum names. We can look at any of these and see that there were some serious sell programs that started on Tuesday. And if you recall, one of the things that I've been talking about over the last several weeks are my concerns that the amount of money that has been attracted into some of these names and some of the ETFs that are pushing these, like ARK Investments, that have, I would say, not single-handedly, but have really been at the forefront of pushing up these names, and you know the names, we know the names, quite significantly over the last several months, if not the last year. And I was wondering, I mean, what does it look like when some of this money flow starts to reverse? I tweeted that a couple of weeks back, I believe it was, or maybe a week and a half back. And I said, you know, watch out. If we see that these flows that have been attracted into these very concentrated, actively managed ETFs start to turn from the buy to the sell. You know, when you have an ETF like ARK, their innovation fund that owns 10%, I think it was 8.5% before the first drop, and then 10.5% they bought back into Tesla. And when you see Tesla off 30-something percent from its highs, it's a big problem because now all of a sudden that selling that is happening, possibly people pulling their money out of the ARKK, that's the symbol of the ARK Innovation Fund, they have to then sell some of their positioning. And as they sell their positioning, it kind of creates a feedback loop. Selling begets more selling, and people start panicking, and all of a sudden, this is gigantic. Now that Tesla's down 32%, from its high. ARK is down 25% from its high. And not to take anything away from the fact that both these names have had huge runs over the past year. Not only those names, but also the big momentum names and the SPACs. And what was really interesting, I thought, was that move that we saw on Monday and then Tuesday, you know, the upside move. And then Tuesday, kind of some selling in there. Wednesday, more selling. Thursday, it started really that forced kind of indiscriminate selling really picked up. And then Friday was a bloodbath. Now, mind you, there was a big turnaround on Friday at the 11:30 hour where things all of a sudden stopped and said, hey, wait a minute. Maybe we're selling these off too much and there's opportunity ahead. And all of a sudden we saw that big turnaround. However, what I saw towards the end of Thursday and into Friday was indiscriminate selling. You know, in the old days, we would say it looked like there was somebody that had a fat finger on the futures and just blew them out. And everything underneath it just caved in. But you could look at certain names in the universe of the momentum style stocks and see that, you know, when Tesla opens up at $636 on Friday and hits a low of $539, closing back at $597, or ARK opening at $119, trading down to $106, closing at $118, almost unchanged on the day. Those are some very significant ranges. I mean, they're almost one, you have to wonder what is actually happening. Because we saw that there were a lot of stocks down 5% intraday Friday, some of the mega caps before this magical rally again at 11:30. There was plenty of other names, though, that were down 10, 15, 20% on the day before reversing and either ending up just off the open or, you know, slightly down, or some actually moved into the green. And when I think about it again, I look back at the action on Monday. You could almost think that that was a clue to some of the things that were going to go on. This wicked rally, this tear your face off, this wow move, short squeezing everything out there on Monday is often a signal that, hey, maybe we're in more of a corrective action kind of market, or maybe even a bear market. These kinds of moves you see that are exaggerated to the upside usually only occur, usually, in bear markets. Now, I'm not saying there's a bear market. Clearly a corrective market right now. Corrective action is happening. Very ugly action, especially in the previous winters. I mean, we look at the solars, the EVs. You look at the SPACs and tech that were all the winners under the pandemic trade, under the trade where people were just throwing money to figure, oh my gosh, you know what, let's just get it in there. And there was more of a gambling environment that was going on, as we know with some of the names like the meme stocks. But valuations just didn't matter because there was this notion that interest rates will stay low forever, and the federal government was going to continue to push significant amounts of stimulus onto everywhere, everyone, every place, and it was going to trickle down into the markets. And even as the economy started to get better, we saw a pretty good, better jobs number, and of course the unemployment rate dropping again on Friday. And that was a signal, again, for yields to rise, a spike above 1.6%, which is still considered very low, by the way, but not low in the standards of a 0.6, a 0.7, and under 1% 10-year. And now, all of a sudden, valuations matter, which does happen on a regular basis. Just to let you in on a little secret, valuations matter. They may not matter for a period of time, but over the long haul, there is a very basic, I would say, code to abide by and adhere to in the markets, that valuations will matter over time.
And you could see that there was a really pronounced move that I think justifies that statement. And it was on the index front. If you look back and look over time, first we'll start with last week where small cap growth was down 4% for the week, yet small cap value was up 3.5%. That's a 7% differential. And when you think about how significant that is from an index standpoint, you have to realize that, wow, you know what? Valuations matter, because what was happening is that we're seeing the rotation into better valued positions and a sell from those places that had valuations that couldn't be justified. We saw similar action in the large and mid-cap areas as well. Now, while value is still trailing the growth counterpart over the one-year basis, it's not trailing as much as it has been, let's say, back in December. So where are we right now? Well, we're going through a corrective action where there is the idea that, well, if we're going to have this reopening and we're going to see that there's a significant amount of the population that becomes vaccinated, and we're seeing that the economy is doing a bit better, well, why should we have these emergency levels of interest rates? And as such, how do we therefore justify the valuations on some of these names? Now, with that in mind, let me just do a quick turnaround for you here for one moment and tell you, with all that, not much has changed. We still have pretty low interest rates. I mean, we're still below 2% on the 10-year. And I don't think that the Fed is going to do anything very significant to really change a lot of their idea that they want the economy to overheat significantly for a long period of time in order to make sure that they get back to their base mandate, which is a 2% average rate of inflation, as well as an employment rate that is considered a full employment level. We're not there. And the truth of the matter is that on top of all that, you still have a $1.9 trillion stimulus package that's going to be unleashed, as well as who knows what else they're going to put forth in an infrastructure bill, a Green Deal, that seems to be on the table right behind the passage of this $1.9 trillion deal that seems to be making its way right through and probably going to be signed into law sometime, I would think, maybe next week, if all goes as planned. So with that, the Fed is not going to really allow for interest rates to spike much higher. Now, whether or not they do like an Operation Twist to lower the short-term rates and kind of bring up the long-term a little bit to maintain, or we have to see how this is all going to play out, but I just don't think that the Fed is really going to stand for interest rates spiking much further. Now, maybe up to 2%, but it does seem like they are committed to keeping interest rates very low due to the fact they have to fund a lot of the stimulus that's going on. And they need to do it at low rates in order to make sure that they don't overload and overburden the government, or you and I, with not only a heavy debt, but also a debt service, the cost of the debt itself. So maybe a reality check right now on some of the excessiveness that was there, the froth that we've talked about. But again, I still think there's great buying opportunities here. And, you know, it's funny because, one of the things that we've kind of stayed away from in our managed growth strategy, the TDI managed growth strategy for our clients, is too much hedging in the portfolio. Now, you would have had timed it perfectly over the last week or so to really get a decent hedge. But if you even tried a broad market hedge, it wouldn't have been a significant amount of upside for you, because the markets themselves really didn't play. It was just a very specific area that was the concern. Markets themselves did okay. Dow Jones was up for the week. S&P was kind of just nowhere. Qs or the NASDAQ was down a bit. But nothing significant. Now, yeah, the Qs are down from their high 5% for the year. Or no, excuse me, 10% off their highs for the year. Okay, that's a big move. But again, you had to pick it just right, time it just right. And that's pretty hard. Pretty hard to do. So bottom line here is that right now, it doesn't seem like a lot has changed. But what we talked about last week, which I'm going to get into in a second and kind of revisit that, is something we need to continue to do. Before we do that, I think it's a good time to let you know about Interactive Brokers, their mutual fund marketplace. Because this marketplace that Interactive Brokers has provides low-cost access to more than 40,000 mutual funds, including 36,000 no-load funds, 8,300 no-transaction fee funds. With no proprietary funds, the mutual fund marketplace provides access to funds from third parties, including prominent fund families like Allianz, BlackRock, and Fidelity. And did you know, maybe you didn't, Interactive Brokers is Benzinga's pick as the number one best broker for mutual funds in 2021. Learn more and visit ibkr.com/funds and learn why. Now, several of you have told me that, well, you've been chasing the Momo stocks and some of the ETFs out there and have been just crushed over the past couple of weeks. And I know it's been rough. And I want to talk about that for a second because I've received too many emails and calls about this. People kind of panic throughout the week. And the first question I think you need to ask yourself, and I want to ask you, is, was this or is this a part of a diversified approach? I mean, how big is the positions that you're talking about? And if you think about your portfolio with what you have in it that really took a hit, was it aligned with your risk profile? It's all peaches and cream and happy pappiness when everything is going up, but not so much during corrections, right? So I think that one of the things that we need to really focus in on is that we really need to remember that corrections happen. Yeah, I know that we thought for a while that, oh, you know what? It's going to be just up, up, up all the time. But corrections happen. They happen for many reasons, sometimes even no reasons at all. I mean, this time we may be able to blame some of the excess valuations that I've been talking about a past while and the yields and all that. And I've been pounding the desk on this issue on what seems like weeks or maybe even months right now. And I'm not saying that there's not room in your portfolio for speculative plays. In fact, there are great opportunities, trading opportunities, we'll call it speculative opportunities. And in fact, even in the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, we have a segment in there for trading and for speculative positions. And that was hit for the week, but it's a manageable piece of the portfolio that we've been actually raising and lowering as these positions move back and forth and when opportunities present themselves. And we're trimming and taking gains. I talked about this a lot over the last couple of weeks on this show. We talked about pruning, trimming. On DH Unplugged, I had a special like public service announcement about it. I said, listen, you got to remember that trees don't grow to the sky. And the fact is that you have to trim your garden and your trees and make sure that everything is looking okay. You need to make sure that you do not have an excessive amount beyond your risk in your portfolio that's going to be very painful if something goes, well, awry. So we took some gains. We took positions almost totally out. Left a little, just a little position in there so that we could build on if it's appropriate. And then add it. And then took out, took those gains, took those profits, moved back in. And again, it was a rough period last week for some of those positions. But again, it was a manageable piece of the portfolio. So when I talk about this idea of trimming and pruning, were you listening and did you act or did you, okay. Because the way it sounded from people that I talked to, and again, just random listeners called me, wrote me saying, oh, what do I do about this position or that position? I'm not going to give you, to be honest with you, individual advice on this. And that's what I tell you back in your emails. But I want you to think about something. Are you being disciplined? I mean, it's a big question. Or you just listen and say, okay, sounds good. It's at Horowitz again giving me advice, but I'm not going to do anything with it because it's kind of fun what's happening. Disciplined investing. Discipline to take those gains and wait for better opportunities. And if you didn't, now what? Here's what I have to say to you. If you were stubbornly holding on to positions that you were, I would say, questioning, but yet you didn't want to get rid of it because you just didn't want to miss out. The idea that you have in your portfolio a certain position, let's just take one position as an example, and let's say it's a certain dollar amount. Let's just for the heck of it say that right now, let's say you invested $20,000 and it's worth $10,000. Let's take an extreme example of something here. Or you invested, you know, $20,000, it's worth $15,000, but it was worth $28,000. What do you do? What do you do? I want you to think about this a little bit differently because a lot of you have been, I'm going to wait for this just to come back and then think about doing something differently. Well, that's a really crappy plan. What I want you to do instead is this, pretty simple. I want you to look at that position. I want you to look at, forget the name, forget what you bought it at, forget where it went to. I want you to look at what it is valued at right now. And I want you to ask yourself, I want you to think about this. That $10,000 that's in that investment, doesn't matter what the investment is. If I was to have that $10,000 right now, would I place it back into that investment? Or would I put it somewhere else? That's the baseline thinking about positions. It's that simple. Don't overthink it. You need to do the work. You need to be disciplined. And you're not going to be looking at just this break-even point as a goal. You can ask yourself, are there better places to invest that money right now and then act accordingly? And in the flip side of it, because you may say, well, but if I take it out and it goes up, I'm just going to be horrified. And what you can do is take a portion of that money and say, well, this other investment looks like there's a greater opportunity. I'm going to move a part of that $10,000, $2,500, $5,000 of it and still hold a position that I can build on if it starts acting right. Because otherwise, you're going to get sucked in like you probably were over the last week or so with the idea that, hey, you know what? It will come back and then you're down to the 25%, not knowing what to do, paralyzed, and just sitting there with a loser. Something to think about. All right, we're going to be segueing to a topic that we all need to know about because it's tax time right now, our favorite time of the year. And we're going to do that right after we talk about our crowd, because a lot of you have wished that, and this is something we've been talking about here, right? That you were in on some of the best performing IPOs of 2019 and 2020. And our crowd investors were. And now you can join them in what's next. With our crowd, accredited investors have access to invest directly, easily, and most importantly, early. Our crowd investors have benefited from our crowd companies IPOing like Beyond Meat or being bought by companies like Intel and Nike, Microsoft, and Oracle. And today, you can join our crowd's investment in Nexa 3D, a 3D manufacturing innovator that's shaping the future of a projected $150 billion market. Nexa 3D's best-in-class solutions give customers a productivity advantage of 20 times their competitors, up to 85% lower cost. That's pretty significant. Now, you can get in early on Nexa 3D and other unique opportunities at ourcrowd.com/TDI. Remember that Our Crowd does in-depth due diligence, including meeting with management teams and comprehensive vetting of deals they decide to make part of their own portfolio. The Our Crowd account is free. Just go to ourcrowd.com/TDI. All right, it's time to talk taxes. Let's bring on our guest. And our guest today is Dan Pila. He is admitted to practice before the United States Tax Court and has consulted to just so many tax professionals out there, attorneys, CPAs, enrolled agents from around the country, has been probably the nation's leading participant in the taxpayer rights defense and IRS abuse prevention. We've had him on before. I thought it would be a great time to bring him back because it is getting to that time again. Yeah, it's tax season. So let's go through some of the things. I mean, Dan has written books. He's done research and written papers and articles. Dan, you have, what is it, 14 books out?
Yeah, actually 15 books now, Andrew. My latest book, Dan Pilla's Small Business Tax Guide, was released about a year ago. So we're up to 15 here now.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Well, thank you.
All right, so again, with tax season right here, I thought we'd get some pointers maybe, first of all, on what to do to get ready. You know, it's not too late, right?
Well, no, it's not too late to plan for what you might owe the IRS, Andrew, for sure. It's too late to get any deductions right now. Of course, when the calendar rolls over from December 31st to January 1st, you know, that prior year is basically shut down. Unless you want to make an IRA or a 401k contribution, you can still do that up until the filing deadline for the tax return, April 15th. But anything else, of course, the door is closed. But what I'm let me tell you what I'm concerned about here, Andrew. This is showing up here now in the clients that I'm talking with over the last couple of weeks. We had during 2020, and it's continuing now into 2021, we had more than 50 million people getting unemployment benefits during 2020 because of the COVID pandemic, right?
Right.
And so massive amounts of unemployment and, frankly, massive amounts of unemployment compensation pouring into people's bank accounts across the country. Here's what I'm very concerned about. There's not one person in 1,000 that realizes these unemployment benefits are taxable at the federal level. Now, not all states tax unemployment benefits. Most of them do, frankly, but not all of them. But the federal government does tax unemployment benefits just like wage income. The problem, Andrew, is virtually nobody gets any withholding taken out of those unemployment compensation benefits. You get the whole check. And because your unemployment is only a fraction of what you ordinarily would earn, right? So let's say your normal wage income is, let's say, $5,000 a month, and you're getting unemployment to the tune of $2,500 a month. Well, you're getting half your monthly income, right? But your bills aren't cut in half. You still have to pay all of your monthly bills. So who sets aside money to pay taxes on unemployment compensation? Virtually nobody.
I find that really interesting. I'll tell you why, because I have counseled several clients and people on this whole thing. And every single time I said, you know what? Withhold the money. Because it's, you know, what happens is psychological, right? You know, if I was, just in your example where, okay, I'm getting $2,500 per month of unemployment, if that's what you got, well, okay, you spend it. If I got $2,200 a month, well, that's what I'll spend. You know what I'm saying? So
I know exactly what you're saying, but here's what the problem is. And I've had the same conversation with people, except what happens is this. If your bills are $5,000 a month and you're only getting $2,500, then people are in an impossible situation.
Right. Yeah.
Do you pay your taxes or do you feed your family? Well, of course they're gonna feed the family.
Yeah. So what's gonna happen? Let's fast forward here to now you file the taxes and you're still unemployed. Now let's take that scenario, okay? And now all of a sudden you're thinking, all right, I didn't make any money last year, right? That's the concept. That's what everybody's thinking.
Yeah,
I didn't make any money.
People are thinking, yep, I didn't make any money. I won't owe them anything.
Right. And then you get this, you're all of a sudden like, wait a second. How come I have a $3,000 tax bill?
Right.
So,
well, there's a couple things. I'm sorry, you go ahead.
No, so what could people, you're going to probably get into this, but what could people do? Because, the money's due. Let's just face that. It's not like you could say, no. But what do people, what's the tactic here?
Well, there's actually three different steps you can take, depending on your situation, Andrew, to mitigate this and keep yourself out of a situation where the IRS is going to run you over in terms of collection. All right, so plan A. Let's talk about plan A. Plan A is Form 1127. This is one of the best kept secrets the IRS has in its entire system. They just simply lie about this form and they lie about the right that people have in connection with the form. And let me tell you what it is. Form 1127 is called an application for an extension of time to pay the taxes. All right. Now, we all know about the filing extension. Form 4868 gets you more time to file the return. But when you get an extension of time to file, that is not an extension of time to pay. People think it is, but it is not. All right, so you have to use Form 1127, and you file that form on or before April 15th. You can get up to 6 additional months to pay your taxes without penalties. That's the key, is the IRS will withhold penalties if they grant that extension. Now, this extension is not automatic. All right, you have to make a showing to the IRS that that you can't pay on time, that payment would cause a hardship, that circumstances beyond your control prevented you from being able to pay on time. Well, of course, that's going to be a no-brainer here with the COVID situation, right? And so it's got to be filed on or before the due date of the tax return, Form 1127. That would be Plan A.
Okay, got it. Plan right? A, got it.
All right. So Plan A. Let's talk about Plan B, because There's a lot of folks listening right now that say, well, okay, that's great news, extension of time, 6 months, but 6 months isn't going to be enough time for me. I might still be unemployed, or maybe they owe substantially more money than they could pay in 6 months' time. Now we go to Plan B. Plan B is Form 9465. Form 9465 is called an installment agreement request. You file that form. You can file it with your tax return. You can actually file that form at any time. There's no deadline for that form per se. But what that form does, Andrew, is it sets the wheels in motion to get you set up on an installment agreement where you can pay the taxes over a much longer period of time than 6 months, right? So, and the way this works is typically if you owe the IRS less than $50,000 and you can pay them within 72 months, then the IRS will pretty much set up that installment agreement. Just do that simple math. They'll set up the installment agreement to allow you to pay over time. So that gives you much more than 6 months to pay if 6 months isn't going to be enough time. Now, the bad news with that
is that interest.
Interest, no matter what, regardless of what plan we're on, interest applies. But penalties also apply under the long-term installment agreement. But there's good news there too. The good news there is that if you can demonstrate to the IRS that the failure to pay is due to reasonable cause and not deliberate disregard of your payment responsibilities, then the penalties do not apply, right? This is the so-called reasonable cause exception. Every tax penalty has a reasonable cause exception. And when we're talking about failure to pay, it's your responsibility as the taxpayer to demonstrate to the IRS that you exercised reasonable business care and prudence in providing for your tax. In other words, you did the things that an otherwise responsible person would do knowing that you had to pay, but due to circumstances beyond your control, you couldn't. Now, when we've got a nationwide medical emergency, right?
National emergency because of COVID. Yeah, that should qualify.
It qualifies. Yeah, absolutely course, yeah. Qualifies. And so you've got long-term unemployment. You've got a situation where your job was basically terminated by the actions of a governor someplace in ordering shutdowns and whatnot. That absolutely is going to qualify, Andrew. There's just no question about it.
And how do you tell them that? I mean, do you have to write in a letter? Is it somewhere on the form?
Yeah, you have to write a letter. It's not on Form 9465. Form 9465 is just a very simple 3 or 4 line math quiz. That's all it is, right? Here's what I owe divided by 72. Here's what I can pay. All right. So that's real, real simple. The application for penalty cancellation is done through a separate written communication to the IRS. You send the letter in writing. You set forth detailed facts that will allow the reader to come to the conclusion that you acted in good faith and based on a reasonable cause, as I explained, and then the IRS will consider that and they'll rule on it. Now, what happens typically, Andrew, because when you're dealing with these frontline IRS reviewers, they've never seen a case in their life that they think constitutes reasonable cause.
Yeah, yeah.
So almost always they deny it on the front end, which means you have to execute an appeal, which is very, very simple. You file a simple letter challenging their determination and asking for an appeal. You got an absolute right to have the case reviewed by the Independent Office of Appeals. Case gets assigned to an appeals officer. And that's the place, Andrew, where you get somebody who's reasonably intelligent, that knows what the law is, that understands how to apply the facts, and that generally comes to the correct decision.
I like that modifier, reasonably intelligent.
Yeah.
You're not going to stick your neck out for them. Yeah, I got it. But now, how long, this seems like it's going to take a while. I mean, nothing in the government is like send an email and get an email back within 20 minutes.
No, that's just impossible. And frankly, that's a pipe dream. And quite honestly, Andrew, under ordinary circumstances, this was not a fast process. I tell my clients regularly, they move like glaciers and they don't care about your life. And that's just, you know, there's just, it's insurmountable as far as the time delay is concerned. But now with the COVID factor figured into the equation, it's even worse because about 75% of the IRS personnel right now are working from home. They're not getting into the office regularly. They're not answering the folks that are in the office regularly, aren't answering the mail regularly. So we got last count, according to the National Taxpayer Advocate, there's about 6 million pieces of mail stacked up in the IRS's mail centers. And they're just, you know, kind of slogging through it as best they can. But, you know, they're obviously affected by this as well. In all fairness to the agency, you know, as I said, 75% of their people are at home and they were shut down completely between about middle of April through end of July, at least they were shut down completely. And so there were 20 million pieces of mail that piled up during that period of time.
Now call me conniving, but it would seem like this is the year of any year that if somebody, I'm not asking for your blessing here, I'm just making a comment, that if this is the year of any year to fudge a little bit on your tax return, it would seem like the chance of audits are a lot lower due to the fact they just need to pile through and plow through their just basic returns.
Well, here's what's wrong with the theory, apart from the legality of it. Let's just
Set
the legality
aside. Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Right. But you're just speculating. I get it. But here's the practical problem with that. The IRS's computers don't shut down, all right? Those computers are operating. And so what happens is we've got about 2 billion, Andrew, that's with a B, 2 billion information returns, forms W-2 and 1099 that are filed with the IRS every year. And the overwhelming majority of those are filed on they're e-filed, right? Mm-hmm. So they get pumped into the system very, very quickly. And so now you come behind that with your tax return, which also the majority of returns filed these days are e-filed. It's probably around 80-85% of all the returns filed are e-filed now. So they get processed pretty quickly. And so what happens is once those returns are filed and the information returns are filed, what happens is the IRS's computers scan those databases and they compare all the information returns in your name with your Social Security number with all the income reported on your tax return. So if the IRS has got information returns that show that you got $50,000 in wages and unemployment and you only report $40,000 on your tax return, guess what? You're getting a notice. So while it's true that face-to-face examinations are down, the face-to-face audit sitting across the table from an IRS guy who's rummaging through your shoebox full of records, those are down. But the machine audits, the electronic audits, are up, and they're up by triple digit increases over the last several years, and that's not going to change in 2021. Right. They are looking at all these returns electronically.
All right, so let's roll back. We had Plan A, we had Plan B for those people that were going to be possibly stuck with a tax bill that they didn't expect. What's Plan C?
Yeah, now we're at Plan C, and you know you got listeners out there that say, okay, great, long-term installment agreement, that's all well and good, but I'm still living on half my income or less. You know, I read a report today, Andrew, that said that about 35-36% of all the small businesses in the country are facing imminent shutdown because they don't have cash reserves to get them through the first quarter of 2021.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we got millions of people across the country that don't have the capacity to pay their living expenses. In that situation, people need to understand that the IRS can't levy from you what you don't have. Let me be more accurate about that. They can't institute enforcement action that would cause quote unquote hardship. Now, hardship is legally defined by the Internal Revenue Service in the law and regulations. Hardship is legally defined as the inability to pay necessary living expenses. So if you're getting, let's just use our example of the guy getting $2,500 a month self-employment, his normal wage income was $5,000 a month, and you know, like two-thirds of the people in the country, Andrew, he's living paycheck to paycheck, meaning that he's spending every nickel of the $5,000 on necessary living expenses, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now he's got $2,500 unemployment compensation. It's not nearly enough to pay the bills. Obviously, this guy cannot afford to pay the IRS anything on the delinquent liability.
Mm-hmm, right.
In that situation, the IRS has the authority to close the case down as currently not collectible. In other words, they code this as a financial hardship. They put the case, they take it off the stove, they put it on the shelf. It's not even on the back burner. It's off the stove, on the shelf. And when you demonstrate when you demonstrate that that hardship will ensue, they must close the collection file. They cannot execute enforcement action that will cause a hardship. So that will close the case as uncollectible. And when they're put on the shelf, Andrew, they will often stay there for at least 2 years and sometimes more, depending on the situation. Now, of course, the interest runs, so that's the bad news. But at least the IRS is off your back and out of your face until you can get back on your feet.
But it's, so let's just be clear, though. It's off the stove. It's off the back burner. It's on the shelf. It is not forgotten.
It's not forgotten.
It is not forgotten.
Very important. It is not forgotten. And here's the thing. The IRS has 10 years from the date a tax is assessed in which to collect it, all right? So even if it sits there for 3 or 4 years, that doesn't mean it goes away. The case can get be revived, and they are looked at from time to time periodically, and so then the IRS will reach back to the taxpayer. Let's say 3 years go by. The IRS will reach back to the taxpayer and say, essentially, look, we've had you on the shelf for all this time, but now it's time to reevaluate. So give us updated financial information. Let's see where you're at now.
Right.
And if your circumstances have changed for the better, they're going to want a piece of it. And if you're still in a situation where you can't make a payment, they'll close the file again.
So when it comes to some of the other gotchas throughout the year, we had something that happened last year that another thing I think people may have taken advantage of. You know, like when I say taking advantage of work, you know, getting unemployment is not something great that you took advantage of. It's not like a benefit, but, you know, it was money that you got and people maybe didn't do it correctly with their withholding. But the other thing was that there was the payroll tax deferral that went on last year, right?
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Between September 1st and December 31st, employers had the option to defer payroll tax collections on their employees for that 4-month period of time. And it's a deferral. It's not a forgiveness, right? So it's not a tax cut. It was just basically kicking the can down the road on what amounts to 7.5% of your income. And the IRS issued directives toward the end of 2020 saying that those taxes had to be paid by the, I believe it was the end of May of 2021. I think that's when it was, what the deadline was. It was either the 1st of May or the end of May. So yeah, that can was just kicked down the road, and that may be a gotcha for a number of people.
You know, because you have situations where some things were fixed, right? You know, we'll talk about the PPP and the EIDL in a second, but
sure.
This is an issue where it could be a surprise for some companies that didn't really, well, some companies that still don't, let's not surprise, let's say it differently, that if you still don't have the ability to pay it, right? And now what you did is compounded your problem with more bills on the back end. And we also know that payroll taxes are not something to screw around with. The government takes it very seriously, both sides of the payroll taxes, more so if you withhold payroll taxes from your employees and don't pay them, but also you as a company not paying the payroll taxes to the government, the penalties can be pretty severe, right?
Well, yeah, you couldn't be more right about that. This is, and I'll tell you where the gotcha comes in with this. You know, a lot of people are, you know, they set up their businesses, rightfully so, as corporations or LLCs or you know, some entity, so that they get some liability protection, right? I mean, that's the key with respect to these business entities is liability protection. Well, they wake up one day, business owners wake up one day to find out the hard way that this liability insulation does not apply to delinquent employment taxes. The IRS can reach right through that corporate veil or the LLC structure, and they can assess that tax liability against the owners or shareholders that were responsible for withholding the taxes that didn't withhold it or withheld it but didn't pay it over to the IRS on time. It's called the trust fund recovery penalty. And it, as I said, it reaches right through any corporate structure that you've set up. And it becomes a personal liability, Andrew, so they can collect it from your personal assets, your IRA, you know, your any savings that you have, your house, your car, whatever assets you have, they can collect from that. So that's a huge problem. And that's why, I spent a great deal of time on that in my book, Dan Pilla's Small Business Tax Guide, for exactly that reason, showing you how to avoid these penalties, to stay out of these problems.
There's other things. It's a lot of little things. Like, for example, there may be some benefits, though. For example, people working at home. And maybe now you have the opportunity, if you can, under certain circumstances, depending on how you're structured, depending on if you're an employee or not, depending on if you got any money for it, you could possibly do a home office deduction, can't you?
Yeah, you could possibly do that. But this is one of the big myths that's flying around right now, Andrew, that frankly needs to be straightened out. And that is that if you're an employee, right, you're working for
right.
some company.
I'm getting a W-2. That's all I'm getting.
Right? Yeah. W-2, you've been ordered to work from home because of company policy or because of a government shutdown order, that now you are automatically entitled to a home office deduction. And that's not true. All right, for W-2 employees, the home office deduction was essentially eliminated with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that took effect in January 2018, so it's got nothing to do with COVID, because the home office deduction was classified as an unreimbursed employee expense, a miscellaneous itemized deduction is what it was, and all the miscellaneous itemized deductions are eliminated under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in favor of a doubling of the standard deduction. So your married filing jointly standard deduction went from about 12 grand to about 24 grand. So you're not going to, as an employee, you're not going to get a separate deduction on your tax return for home office expenses.
That's a problem, because a lot of people, if you think about that for a second, they also not only did they convert or at least change one of their rooms in their homes, or two maybe, to be available for home office work, but they, everybody went out to Wayfair and various places and got desks and maybe even bought computers, and none of that is deductible.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And this is why I've encouraged folks in my writing over the period of 2020 on this issue, which there's been a lot of it. I've encouraged folks to sit down with their employer and say, look, here's the expenses that I've incurred. Can we get some reimbursement? This is what people need to understand. The employer can reimburse these expenses, Andrew, and it becomes a double benefit in this sense. The employer gets a deduction for the expenses he reimburses to the employee, because they're ordinary necessary business expenses for the employer. There's no doubt about that. And because it's a reimbursed expense, the employee doesn't have to claim it as income on his tax return. All right. So that's the way the problem is solved. Get the employer, if you possibly can, to reimburse all or part of the expenses. And at least, if they reimburse all of them, of course, it takes all the sting out of it. And if they reimburse part of it, it takes, takes some of the sting out of it, at least.
Now, what about something like this? This is kind of a little bit convoluted, but just let me just go there and you could either smack me down or tell me there's something here.
Okay.
You're a W-2 employee. That's all. You're not nothing else. You don't have 1099 income coming in, nothing. You're a W-2 employee. Is there a way to set up a secondary company in your name and possibly do something like pay consulting fees to that company, utilize that as potential write-offs within that company? And I'm not sure if
IRS,
that actually...
I mean, it's not crazy thinking, Andrew, but the fact of the matter is the IRS is just going to trace the income stream back to the source, which in this case is the employer's, the paycheck from the employer, and they're going to say that that's where the deduction has to be attributable to the income source. And if it's ultimately then income from an employer, then it's not going to be deductible. Here's the other problem you got with the home office. And I'm telling you, people just do not understand this. And that is this: the space used in your home to be deductible, there's the space used in your home has to be used regularly and exclusively for business purposes. Right? Regular and exclusive business use. So if you've got your computer set up on the dining room table, Andrew, and you use that computer, 5, 6, 7 hours a day for business, and then the computer gets put away and you sit down at the kitchen table or dining room table and you have dinner, and then it stays clear for the evening and you have breakfast in the morning, and then you drag the computer out again at 9:30 and you're back to work on the kitchen table. Well, guess what? That's not regular and exclusive business use. Even a self-employed person that otherwise might qualify for the home office is going to lose it under those criteria.
Mm. Unbelievable. Now, the PPP program, the Payroll Protection Program for companies, the EIDL, there was a big kerfuffle about what was happening because originally everybody who got that thought, oh, you know what? Well, I get this money and it's tax-free. And then they like later found out that, well, not really. It's not so tax-free because what's going to end up happening is any of the money that you used that for, if you use it for payroll, for rent, for utilities, things of that nature, that is no longer a deductible expense. And then they kind of went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And finally, it seems the rules did change in favor of essentially making it a tax-free payment, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You're precisely correct. They went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth until finally Congress spoke on the issue with the Consolidated Appropriations Act that was passed in December, signed into law by former President Trump at the end of December. That contains a couple of provisions that make it crystal clear that money that businesses, or I should say that expenses that businesses pay with PPP money are tax deductible. There's no question about it. But let me tell you what I'm concerned about, Andrew, and I'm concerned about this to the point where I've reached out to individuals in my own state legislature here in Minnesota. A lot of state laws do not conform to the federal tax laws. Uh-huh. Minnesota is one of them, all right? So the Minnesota has to very specifically pass laws that conform to the federal law, or Minnesota law is different. Under Minnesota law, the forgiveness of any loan is taxable income, and PPP is no exception.
Really?
Right. So under federal law, when a PPP loan is forgiven, you don't have debt forgiveness income as a result of it. It's specified in the CARES Act. It's not considered taxable income. But if a company has a PPP loan forgiven under Minnesota law, they have to report that as debt forgiveness income.
Just to stop you, that's for states that have a state income tax.
Correct. Yeah. Now, right. Folks in Florida won't have this problem. But folks in New York will have the problem. Folks in Minnesota will have the problem. You know, wherever state law does not automatically conform to federal law, which isn't that many of them, I think there's only about 8 or 9 of them that do that. Of course, there's another 7 or 8 that don't have an income tax at all. So, you know, approximately, 12 states or so, it's not going to be a problem. But all the rest of them, it's a potential problem.
And then what about the potential for a tax credit offset against your federal return if, in fact, that becomes a taxable event?
The federal government is not going to give you credit for it because the federal government's not taxing it to begin with. Mm. So now it gets more complicated, or I should say more nefarious than that. It's not complicated. It's nefarious. Here's the problem. The PPP program required that the proceeds be used in very specific ways. All right. 60% of it had to be used for payroll, and the rest of the 40% could be used in a number of different areas. But the payment of state income taxes, Andrew, was not one of them. So by law, you can't use the money, the PPP money, to pay state taxes.
Yeah, but the problem is they'll be very difficult to figure out what you actually paid for. As long as you have the expenses that met the number, you can always kind of put together something and show that it would be the total. You know what I mean? Did you really pay your rent? You can't trace the dollar. Right.
Well, you can't trace a specific dollar. That's true because money's fungible. There's no question about that. But I'll tell you what, the burden of proof is on the taxpayer to do exactly that, Andrew. They have the specific affirmative burden of proof to show exactly where that money went. This is why I advised all my clients to set up a separate bank account.
Right.
All right. When you're getting your PPP loan, fund a separate bank account with that money only. And then now we can trace exactly what dollar went where.
Right. You know, I know you love this area of the world, the world of taxes, but I got to tell you, you know what? I'm thinking out loud here for a second. You are in the minority. You are in the minority.
You think?
The complexity of all this, because let's be honest, you know, there's every time you look at something, you're like, well, wait, hold on a second. And then they change the rule. And just as you get comfortable with the rule, you know,
I'm telling you, Andrew, You couldn't be more correct. I don't care how complicated the rule is. Give me some time. We'll sort it out. The problem arises when they change the doggone rules twice a month for 6 months. This PPP program was changed. I can't tell you how many times. I was rewriting the same article 2 and 3 times a month, Andrew, over the course of 2020 because these rules were getting changed so fast.
Unbelievable. What's happening with charitable deductions for businesses, business lunches now, other things? I mean, there's a big issue that, you know, they cut down the business, quote unquote, business lunch. And then everybody got, then they put it back. They're like, the three martini lunch is back because you can now deduct it, which was kind of a theoretical help for businesses that you'd go out if you could go out, if they were open, et cetera. What about things like, you know, the dues to country clubs? And what about all those kinds of things that were in the past that really were perks for businesses? Is that, that's, it's kind of been a little bit taken away, a little bit given back, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's some give and take on that stuff, too. I will say this, Andrew, the deduction for club memberships, you know, you go to the country club, you pay for your golf club membership, your tennis club membership, and you say, well, you know, I use this regularly to meet customers and clients, and that certainly may be true, and in fact probably is true, and you know, great many deals have been made on the golf course, as we all know, and that's fine. But the deduction to businesses for club memberships has been gone for a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it might be as long as 20 years that deduction's been gone, maybe even more. Now, where we got into a tizzy in the last couple of years is with the treatment under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of the elimination of entertainment expenses.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So now, and that's the law today, Andrew, if you take a client to a baseball game, all right, and you pay for the tickets for the baseball game, the participation in a baseball game is a quintessential entertainment activity, and that expense is not deductible. Now, where the confusion arose is, what is the difference between an entertainment expense and a meal expense? You see, a lot of people mistakenly group the two together as the same thing. Meals and entertainment come under the same umbrella, general broad umbrella entertainment, and therefore they're all not deductible. That's not true. All right, there's a difference between meals and entertainment. So, for example, and the IRS has spoken on this, and as a matter of fact, I did a detailed legal analysis of this in my newsletter when this first came to light, and the IRS issued a revenue ruling that patterned exactly the language of my newsletter, all right? So here's what the law is. There's a fundamental difference between an entertainment activity and a meal, all right? If the entertainment activity is standing alone, like the baseball game, that is now no longer deductible, no question about that.
Okay.
But if there's meals purchased in connection with an entertainment activity, let's say I take you to the baseball game as a client, and I buy hot dogs and beer at the baseball
game.
That's
what I want. That's peanuts. I need the peanuts. I have to have peanuts.
Yeah, exactly. So the meals and the beverages are not inherently entertainment items.
Uh-huh.
The baseball game is, but the meal isn't. And so if the meal is in connection with a legitimate business discussion, bona fide business discussion, either before, during, or after the meal activity with a legitimate customer, client, or patient, or prospective customer, client, or patient, it's deductible.
All right. So now, in a pandemic world, this is what I'm thinking. You line up every day to have a business meeting at about 12 o'clock in the afternoon. You have your lunch, you're probably brought to the office or in the house. You sit down, you talk with a client, and as you're talking, you know, you do a little bit of eating and maybe you put the food aside and stuff during the, that's now a deductible expense.
Well, whose meal are you buying, Andrew?
I'm buying my own, but it's only half of the business meeting.
You're buying your own meal in your own home or office, then that meal is not deductible.
But if I buy a hot dog for you and a hot dog for me at the ball game, both are deductible.
Yes, that's right.
But how about this? How about I buy you a meal on a Zoom call and I have it sent to your house and I have somebody send me something at the same time?
Well, you know, I don't know what the IRS would say about that, quite frankly. I don't know.
Well, maybe you send me a meal and I'll send you a meal anyway. So what else do we have to be looking for in 2020? Now it's 2021, but our 2020 taxes are coming up. What other things? We know that we got the alleviation. So let me just tell you what I did and you can tell me what you think. So a lot of our clients had RMDs, required minimum distributions from their IRAs that were theoretically due every single year. But in 2020, that requirement was waived. And of course, they moved also the age for minimum distributions from 70 and a half, finally got rid of the damn half to 72, because that half thing was always an issue.
Yeah, what the heck is the point of that to begin with?
I don't know. And it was April 1st following your 70 and a half birthday, and then you have to start thinking and figuring, and when was that date? Then, but now we have the RMD that was available to be waived, both for any kind of IRAs, inherited IRAs, everything, waiving the RMD, right?
Right.
We told clients, listen, you can not take it, and just there's no penalty, and you don't have to double up next year or anything like that. However, you know, the thought was that our tax is going to be higher or lower in the future. Now, this is already water under the bridge, but we counseled our clients to take their RMD in 2020 because
in 2020, even though
they didn't have to.
Right.
Even though they don't have to. Because we said, you know what? We don't know what the taxes are going to be like in the future, but with all the debt that's being spent, all the excess money that's going to be, you know, brought in due to this $1.9 trillion over here, this $900 billion over there, $4 trillion over there, the potential for a higher tax bracket in the future is possible. And as
let me stop you there, Andrew, and say this. I think you did exactly the right thing. Because I don't believe it's speculative that taxes will be higher in the future. I think it's a cinch, and I'll tell you why I say that.
I would agree.
The Biden administration has made it perfect. The Biden candidacy has made it perfectly clear that they were going to abolish the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. The Biden administration has made it perfectly clear they're going to do it. He's got the support of the House to do it. He's got the support of the Senate to do it. They are going to repeal the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. If they do that, there is going to be a tax increase for virtually every American, certainly every American that got a tax cut under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which, by the way, was the bottom 80% of income earners. Only the top 20% didn't get a tax cut. So this so-called tax cuts for the rich nonsense is demonstrably false. But when they repeal that, those taxes are going up for everybody.
Yep. And we have to pay it back, right? I mean, we're not on this MMT thing going on where we could just keep spending. You know, this whole idea of just spend, it doesn't matter. And then the theory is, well, if it doesn't matter if we're spending, why do we even need to have taxes? Abolish that too. But
yeah, well, you'd think so. If one is true, the other has to be true.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, taxes are less about raising revenue, and you know this. The taxes are less about raising revenue to fund the legitimate function of government, and more about transferring wealth to make sure that people don't get ahead in life. That's what they're all about.
It is true, Dan Pila. Always a pleasure having you on. So much to talk about. We could probably go on hours for this because the complexity of all this. Tell everybody where they can get their information. We'll also have it on the show notes for this episode over on The Disciplined Investor. But you can get your books everywhere, right?
Yeah, the books are available everywhere. The best place to get them is right off my website, which is taxhelponline.com. If you buy any book off my website, Andrew, you're going to get a free 15-minute consultation directly and personally with me.
No.
So go to taxhelponline.com and check out the books.
So if I do that, can I have lunch with you and then deduct my lunch if I have it sent to you and sent to me?
If you have lunch with me and you pay for lunch and it's obviously going to be a business discussion, then it's deductible.
There you go. Appreciate it. Dan Pila, have a great day, bud. Appreciate it.
All right. You too, Andrew.
Well, plenty in this show for everybody. We talked about the BOMO stocks. We talked about how to trim and prune. We talked about tax issues and some things regarding PPP and some of the other areas that you need to know about, especially if you're getting unemployment compensation. So I think that covers the gamut of today's topics. Hopefully you'll join me again next week. Listen to DH Unplugged. We're coming back live at 9 o'clock Tuesday evening, upcoming this next week. Go to dhunplugged.com and check it out. Anybody that wants some advice and help, maybe in a time now that things aren't maybe going your way in terms of your portfolio and you want to think about, well, maybe I need to change something, well, reach out. I'll talk to you directly. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, any of the contact forms, the Ask Andrew, whatever you want to do, get in touch. We'll figure a way to help you out with whatever is going on. Thank you again for joining me. I am going to see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.
Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.